Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
What comes to mind when you think of kosher wine? We'll talk about that and a lot more today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, I'm Linda Palacio, and today on A Taste of the Past, we're going to explore kosher wines. I think what most people think of in kosher wine is probably not a single vineyard Cabernet from California, or a soft, not too oaky Chardonnay, or even a sparkling Moscato from Italy. No, probably not. I think what most often comes to mind is that perhaps first taste of that cloying, sweet Concord grape wine so many of us know. And for too many years, kosher wines have been almost synonymous with Manischewitz. Not that Manischewitz is a bad thing, but certainly not something you want to drink with a fine meal. Well, get ready for a revelation if these have been your thoughts, because today's kosher wines have come such a long way, along with modern gastronomy. And in doing research for today's show, I was really truly impressed with how many selections, I mean, the vast selection of kosher wines in the market and how many different companies and distributors. Well, I'm fortunate today to have with me one of the representatives from one of the distributors and producers of kosher wine, Jay Buchsbaum from Royal Wine Company. Jay is the Vice President of Marketing for Royal Wines. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you very much, Linda. Glad to be here.
This has been a real education for me. I have to say that over the past few years, friends have come back from Israel with wonderful wine saying, oh, you got to taste this wine. It's really great. And I've been unduly impressed by that, and Israel is pretty much rocking the wine world with a lot of their wines. But it's not just Israel. We're talking kosher wines from all over the world, right?
You bet. There's now, I think, 13 or 14 countries that kosher wines are brought from. Of course, the traditional ones, Spain, Italy, but even more edgy ones, New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, Hungary.
Wines you might be drinking that you're not even aware are kosher wines.
That's right.
Well, tell me, the Royal Wine Company, they've been around for a long time. They've got quite a history in winemaking and wine distributing as well. Tell me a little bit about...
Well, the Herzog family actually started making wine in 1848 in Czechoslovakia. And they were the knighted, if you will, supplier to the crown at that time. In 1948, after being hidden by their own employees during the Holocaust, they left Czechoslovakia and came to these shores and started making traditional wines, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the Manischewitz under the Kedem label type wines, which were also very high quality, but in that sweet syrupy mold.
That was actually my first taste of wine, period, Manischewitz.
And then in the 1960s, they brought in their first Bordeaux. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, you know.
So now they're in the eighth generation of winemakers at the Herzog family, Royal Wine Corp. And we've got a winery in California, the Herzog Winery.
So the family is, there is still Herzog family involved.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. And we've got offices in France and in England and in Israel and hopefully in California, of course, in upstate New York near the wine-growing regions, as well as in New Jersey and New York.
Mm-hmm. I've actually, is Kedem Winery, that's Royal?
That's right.
I've passed by there many times driving upstate. Yeah. All right, so here comes the big question, right? What is kosher wine? What makes the wine kosher?
You know, I do these seminars all the time, and I ask that question to people. Invariably, the biggest answer, or the most frequent answer, is that it's blessed. In fact, the opposite is true. The objective of kosher wine is to keep blessing out of wine. In pagan times, before monotheism, the most famous of all gods of wine was Bacchus and Dionysus, right? And they used to pour wine for those pagan, in those pagan rituals. Well, the rabbis at that time decided that, hey, we don't want that wine used in our daughter's wedding or a son's bar mitzvah or at a circumcision, etc. And so they decreed that from the crushing of the grape until the sealing of the bottle, to make sure that it wasn't defiled spiritually, it was all overseen and handled only by their observant crew. And that's really what makes kosher wine. It's really keeping the blessing out of wine. And it's really, the message is, it's up to you, the consumer, to make that wine special, to make that wine, you know, important, to put the blessing in if that's your proclivity, you know. And that's what kosher wine is. From the crushing of the grape until the sealing of the bottle, it's overseen and handled by an observant Jewish crew.
And what about the boiling of wine? There was, for a long time, it was thought that all kosher wine was boiled wine.
Well, that commonly known in Hebrew is called mivushal, which actually means cooked. But today we put wine that is mivushal through a pre-fermentation thermal stabilization, which means basically that it's flash pasteurized. And often this flash pasteurization takes place at the juice stage, not at the wine stage. Uh-huh. And so fermented wine never sees, in many cases, this kind of... But there are many kosher wines that don't go through this process, and you're going to be tasting some that are and some that aren't today.
Interesting. Well, in the early and mid-century, is that... When did the changeover from the strictly,
sweet wines? Very simple. When Americans or Jewish people came to these shores, starting at the turn of the century, they mostly settled right here in, frankly, Manhattan or Williamsburg, mm-hmm. right?
Here we are, a stone's throw from here. Bushwick, Brooklyn.
And Bushwick. Yeah. In fact, you can see some of the streets are named after some of those early, you know, comers. And anyway, wine is an integral part of every part of Jewish life. Friday nights, every celebration, etc. And the only grapes that were available were the Labrusca variety. Those grapes, in fact, need sugar in order for them to make them palatable. Hmm. And so that's when this tradition, in fact, it's a new tradition. It's only 100 years old or so that kosher wines are sweet. In Europe, wines were made in France, wines were made in Italy, and the Jewish communities there, and I'm sure they were the local wines, which were not sweet at all. So when the change occurred was in the 60s, when, you know, shipping and that kind of thing was much easier to do, and so importation of better wines started the kosher wine revolution here in America in the 60s and has really zoomed up. I mean, Wine Spectator, wine enthusiast Robert Parker are talking about 90s and above in many cases for some of these kosher wines.
So it was really the sweet wine was really more in the sweep of the immigrants coming here and making that. So we have to dispel the notions we have of
Absolutely.
Those origins, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now let's talk about the Israeli wines, which have been, as I said, kind of sweeping the market. Israel, is that it's a good area for growing grapes?
There are so many examples. We're going to be tasting Domaine du Castel, which some consider, excuse me, the Chateau Margaux of Israel. But there's Carmel and Binyamina and Barkan. And these wines, the modern winemaking industry, I should say 100 years ago, was started by the Rothschilds, who brought the first plantings to the Shomron and to Zichron and to areas in the central part of the country, kind of like the southern France varieties of those times. And then in the last, starting in about 1967, actually the first vintages, 1973, the first vintages coming out of the Golan Heights were varietals. Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Cabernet, Merlot, made by the Golan Heights Winery. And today, really doing great stuff with it are, as I said, Carmel, Barkan, Castel, Binyamina, new little boutique wineries, Shiloh, and there's a host of others that have gotten great reviews. That's just really exploded the wine business.
All right. Well, in looking down the list of some of them, I noticed some wines, I guess particularly from Italy and France as well, that I never even realized were kosher wines. I mean, what when you look, let's say that you're in the market to bring a bottle of wine to a Passover Seder, and you want to buy a kosher wine for your host, what do you look for?
I think, just like you would look for any good bottle of wine, when you go to your retailer, if you have a good retailer, and you should, ask him for his suggestions of what, which of these kosher wines for whether it's Passover or Rosh Hashanah or any, or even just you know, to enjoy good wines from Israel, which one of these wines do you suggest? And you know, the producers, invariably us, of course, as being the leaders, want to be judged by the quality of the wine, not by whether it's kosher or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's first and foremost. You know, it's interesting to note that the oldest presses geologically, you know, found are in Israel, not in Italy, not in France. They date back thousands of years. And in fact, the Roman legions would, you know, would use a flagon of wine that they gave to every single one of the troops.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that wine come from? It came from Judean hills, from Jerusalem area.
Hmm.
So what you're really looking for in kosher wines, whether it's from Italy or France, Rothschild out of Chateau Clark is now making delicious Bordeaux, Medocs, that are both in the great tradition of Medoc, but also in the great tradition of kosher, and they're wonderful wines. So what you're really looking for is just great wine that happens to be kosher.
And on the label, is there anything that indicates that it is kosher on the label?
Most wines that are kosher have several different symbols that you can look for. First of all, the word kosher, of course. But even if that word is not there, and some don't have it, have a simple designation, either a circle U or a circle K,
mm-hmm.
or a something called a Kaf K, the Hebrew letter.
So same
Kaf
as you'd
K.
find on the foods.
Exactly.
You know,
I mean, look, you know, take Coors beer has an OU.
Mm-hmm.
Hershey's chocolates have an OU. Hunt's puddings have a circle K. I can go on and on and on. And nobody puts them in the pigeonholed kosher section
right.
in the supermarket. They're right there with the candies or with the vodka or with
no,
the
it's
beers.
And that's absolutely true. So many of the large food manufacturers and companies, I mean, they need that designation.
Right.
Or, you know, they lose a good share of the market. And of course, they, you know, there are different ways they, you know, they have to.
Yeah, there should be no compromise in kosher, especially in when it comes to kosher wine. In fact, you know, if anything, what our objective is to make the wines as good or better as the counterparts of the same varieties in the same price range from the same areas.
All right. Well, we are going to talk a little bit more about this combination of great grapes and kosher designation, and taste a couple wines too when we come back after a short break.
Ranch, ranch manager Cliff Garrison describes their philosophy. Raising cattle on grass is both an ancient practice and one that is standard in much of the modern world. Sometimes the old ways are the right ways. We believe that our methodology is the right one for us. For more information on their premium grass-fed beef, visit HearstRanch.com.
We are back talking about the evolution of kosher wines with Jay Buchsbaum from Royal Wine Company. And Jay, we were talking about some of the history of the of kosher wines, which actually goes back to the history of wine in you know, pagan times, as you were saying.
Right.
So of course we know there were good winemakers all along, but for a long time, and I know only from the American market, kosher wines were not really available in the regular wine stores. You had to look, and it was relegated to a back shelf someplace.
Right.
You know.
Back bottom shelf.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about this, because that's certainly changed a lot.
Well, it's not only the wine shops, but it's also the restaurants. There are several hundred restaurants in the New York metropolitan area now that are carrying one form of kosher wine or another. And again, it's another example is Bartonura Moscato d'Asti is now the largest selling upscale imported wine, Moscato in America. And that's not a kosher designation. I mean, it's just because it's a delicious bottle of wine. And it's not the least expensive either. It's really a high-quality bottle of wine. Baron Herzog and Herzog wines are found on many wine lists throughout the country. And that's, again, you know, it took a long time, starting in the turn of the last century till about the late 60s and mid-70s and finally into the 90s, when the quality of the kosher wines have grown so much that people are recognizing them as just delicious wines.
All right. Well, now you've brought a couple of bottles for us to taste. And I was actually in doing some of the research, I was reading about, you know, when things shifted over, and I ran across an article from Sidney Retzky talking about, kosher wines and Israeli wines and being not what you think. And he said probably the best way for anyone to appreciate the difference or lack of difference is to taste them side by side.
There you go.
We don't have lots of other wine here to taste side by side. So I'm just going to take my taste buds' word for it and tell me what you've got for us to try.
Well, the first wine we're tasting, which just was considered a Best Buy by Wine Enthusiast magazine, is Baron Herzog Chardonnay. And this wine, you know, I do seminars for people all the time, and they think that I'm coming in to talk about kosher wine, and I bring some wines, and I go, you know, when I flew here, I just did this in Ottawa for a group of retailers there, which is owned by the state government, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I said, you know, we forgot the samples, the kosher samples. I do have samples here, but the samples that you're going to be tasting today are not kosher. And then I let that, you know, hang in the air for a minute, and we taste the wine. And then about 2 minutes later, I go, they go, wow, this wine is really delicious. I wonder if the kosher wine is as good, you know? And then I go, I lied. The wine is kosher. So that's what I'd like you to do. Taste it that way.
Well, that's why I said we don't have it side by side, but I'll rely on
this
my own
wine nose. has partial malolactic fermentation. This wine has partial Surlis. This wine has wonderful vanilla and really good structure as well, which is unusual when you have that vanilla and fatness to the wine.
And this is from California.
This is from California. This is from Baron Herzog. It's a 2010 vintage Chardonnay Central Coast. It's got a little bit of Sonoma Chardonnay in it.
It's nice. That is very nice. It's crisp. It's got that soft edge to it.
Right.
And what's the percentage of alcohol in this?
This is 13.3.
Okay. And I did swallow.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's nice about this is that this is a wine that, even though it's got those components, malolactic fermentation, some Surlis, some barrel fermentation, some a bit of aging as well, it's still only about $12 to $14 all over the country.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Very interesting. And as you poured and said something, there was something else I wanted to bring up about that wine, but it is indeed... Oh, when you're talking about Ottawa, though, is the entire wine industry in Canada owned by the state?
Yes.
Wow, I did not know
that. You cannot buy wine in the state in all of Canada almost. Yeah, I think all of Canada, unless you buy from the government.
Well, and that's almost as strict as what, you know, we not almost as strict, not even close, but you know, we still have our strict rules about shipping wines across the state. In fact, I was at an event last night and someone made an ancient hippocress, which is, you know, a sweetened with usually honey or sugar loaves and lots of spices in it. But she made it in California because it had to sit and age for a couple of weeks. They had to don't tell anyone. They had to smuggle. They had basically had to smuggle it in. They, you know, shipped, packaged it up and shipped it as spiced vinegar.
Yeah.
Because it's almost what it is.
Well, you know, we still
have. But we still have, because they're in California and we still have those, you know,
I think
know,
we still
laws.
Have about 11 states that are actually government controlled. Huh. So Pennsylvania, for example, all the wine shops in Pennsylvania, liquor and wine shops, are all owned and operated by the government.
Interesting.
And there are many others. New Hampshire is an example.
Yeah, it makes it a problem. We have to try to get away from those. What are you pouring now?
Here's what we're pouring now is Domaine du Castel. I brought three wines, kind of like a first course wine, a main course wine, and a dessert wine. And this Domaine du Castel is considered by many to be the premier wine from Israel. It comes from... in Hebrew, it's called Har Yehuda, the Judean Hills, and it's made in packed terrazzo lime soil. It has tremendous complexity. It is a what we call a classic Bordeaux blend of Cabernet Merlot, Cabernet Franc, mm-hmm. and Petit Verdot, a drop of Petit Verdot, depending on the vintage, and even some Malbec from time to time. And, well, you tell me.
Okay.
Serena Sutcliffe was the first one to notice it, and invariably they only make three wines. It's interesting. Actually, they're experimenting with a rosé, but they only make three wines, and that's a Grand Vin, Petit Castel, and Castel C. And each one of those wines, every single year, whether it's Parker or Wine Enthusiast or Spectator, gets 90 and above. So
this is a very, very interesting wine. What's the vintage on this?
This is 2009. This is spent at least 2 years in oak. I mean, they're even careful about when they bottle it. They only bottle it at certain times of the moon. You know, when the moon is in certain constellations,
it's like the
in
gardeners.
Order to make sure that everything's perfect.
They're not alone. Gardeners, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They only plant at a certain phase of the moon, and yeah, it's very important
it's really,
to some gardeners.
You know, that's how careful some of these wineries are, whether it be Herzog or Castel or so many of the other wineries.
All right, now let me take a sip of water between here so I can really... that was the wine. Okay. This is very... And what is the... And, they have how many? It's a varietal. So how many different? What do we have in there?
You have 70% Cabernet, 23% Merlot, 5% Petit Verdot, and yeah.
And what would this retail for?
This is about $65.
Interesting. Very fine wine.
Sells out
very
every nice. Year. The entire production, they're considered a medium-sized winery by Israeli standards, and they make about 10,000 cases. By American standards, that's considered a tiny boutique.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we only get around 2,000 cases here of all three varieties a year, and it sells out every year. It's really quite an outstanding wine. But more importantly, or as important as the wine itself, specifically this wine, is the kind of quality that the category of kosher wine has come to. This is an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and as you said, if you had lied to me beforehand and I had just closed my eyes, how am I to know? There's no way I could know. That's very interesting. Very good. Very nice wines. And I hear the glug, glug, glug. He's pouring something else. Aha! Of course, now we have dessert, right?
As I was saying before, I brought three wines. The first wine was meant to be as kind of like the appetizer or the first course wine, a wonderful Chardonnay from California, from Baron Herzog. The second wine was this Grand Vin Castel, which is a great middle wine for...
Mm-hmm. A nice roast.
Yeah. So I actually like this wine with something with complex flavors, not just plain grilled or broiled, but something with...
A nice sauce
with mushrooms and onions and pearl onions and
has a little a little hint of the spiciness to it that can really stand up to a complex dish of a fowl like a deep
and so many of the wines whether
fowl.
They're from Herzog or Binyamina or Castel or Shiloh or Barkan makes great wines at $10, $12, $15. just great.
But well, now this is so. This now we're on to dessert. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So this wine is the famed Bartonura Moscato.
Moscato.
It comes in a blue bottle.
Yeah. When I saw that and I saw you pouring it, I said, "Wait, is this a red or a white?" And then I cheated and I saw the label, but indeed, so it was nice and clear, but blue and very pretty. Yes.
Yeah. And in this category, this is the leader.
It's got a bit of a blush to it, this Moscato.
Well, actually, no. That's
oh, just, that's the leftover red wine in your glass? I thought
you
rinsed.
It's the leftover red wine. Okay. I tried, but I guess we got...
I did. I rinsed. I still, no, it's golden. It's just beautiful golden. It's just, yeah. Okay, let me taste this one. It is definitely a very elegant Moscato. Sweet, which Moscato, you know, unless it's designated as a dry one, is... but the bubbles are very soft. Mm-hmm. It's not an aggressive sparkling, which is very nice. Lovely.
In Italian, we call that frizzante.
Yes.
But
yes.
Also what I love about this wine is that it's not only sweet and delicious and aromatic, it's also got a little bit of a kick of just a tiny drop of acidity that allows it to be beyond that cloyingly sweet mm-hmm. flavor that you get from so many other lesser Moscatos. Mm-hmm. This wine has a little bit of structure so that you can really drink this with, a sweet and sour infused Italian or French or, well, Italian or Chinese.
I would say often with a very spicy sauce, a spicy dish that has, you know, often a very sugary sauce as well, spicy, as you said, sweet and sour.
Right.
Yeah, that would cut it. It would make it.
Because it's got that kick of acidity that allows it to be a little bit more structured than so many others.
Uh-huh. It's very nice. So there are quite a few distributors. Royal is they produce wine, as you said, the Herzog vineyards, but also distribute a lot of the other wines, as we just saw and tasted here today.
Right.
And there are quite a few other distributors throughout of kosher wines. So, I mean, the market should be, you would think, you know, somewhat more, a little more saturated, but people are slow to find out about a lot of these wines. How are you trying to
I'll give you one
make
example.
People aware, There's aware a, of these.
This is listened to all over the country. So, for example, Binney's, which is a chain in Chicago, has set up next to the kosher section, but not in the kosher section, a complete separate section for Israel as a country. And that's happening more and more. Our Chardonnays or our Baron Herzog wines are finding themselves not only in the kosher section, but now in the California section next to other Chardonnays and Cabernets. Our Italian, the Moscato, is finding itself. There are, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania, this Moscato is in approximately 300 locations. You know, there's only about 40 or 50 or 60 locations that are in Jewish areas. So you're going to see more and more as people recognize more and more the wines simply for their quality and recognize that a little bit more extra careful oversight goes into making kosher wine. People are going to recognize it more, and it's going to go into more of the regular sections.
And yet the process is still the same tried and true century, millennia old winemaking procedures that developed
kosher wines,
from the beginning.
Just quickly, kosher wines will not find gelatin in their wines, which some wineries do. Many wineries don't, non-kosher, as a fining agent. Will not find sodium cazonate, which is a dairy byproduct for acidification. They'll use only natural acidification from the grape juice itself, etc. So many good wineries, non-kosher, do the same thing, but you can be rest assured that that happens in kosher wine.
Interesting. Well, it has been a real education for me, I will say, and I hope that our listeners have learned a thing or two as well. And I will now peruse those shelves and look a little closer to see what varieties of wine I find there, and I'm sure that I will recognize a few.
Yeah.
Jay, it's been a pleasure. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us and your wines as well. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going to finish my glass of wine.
Linda, thank you for inviting me. Good luck with your network and your show, and hope
thank
to
you.
Listen to it a lot.
Thank you. Okay, this has been Linda Palacio on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.